Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to John Talk Radio tonight. It's our May the 10th show in 2014. My special guests tonight are Daryl Davis and Scott Shepherd. Daryl Davis, you can reach, just check out all the things that are going on. Daryl's a musician. You just heard Boogeyman from his amazing piano techniques and talents. He's also an author of Clandestine Relationships, an actor, a speaker, and a lot of great things. And you can go on Daryl's, it's daryldavis.com on his online store. And the music you hear, you can pick it up there. And also we have Scott Shepherd on with us. And Scott is an ex-KKK Klansman who is a race relations expert now, going around and talking about some of the things that are very important in today's society. And guys, I just appreciate so much you being on the show tonight. I think this is a very important show to have. And I just really appreciate you taking the time to be on.
Well, thank you for having us.
Appreciate it, John. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you guys. And I want the show to be, you know, what you guys want to say and what from your experiences. Because, Scott, when I was talking to Daryl before, I was so amazed at what he's done, because me, myself, and a lot of people have a lot of commitments and things that we'd like to do and convictions, but very few people have to get up and actually do them. And I think putting feet on your faith and doing what you think is the right thing is such an amazing thing. And I would say the same thing for you, Scott. So thank you so much, because we can talk about things, we can kick things around, we can kick the can back and forth, but actually to do something means a lot to me when I see that happening. Now, what I'd like to do is just open the show up and for both of you to give an introduction of yourselves, and then we want to talk about how your paths crossed. So, Daryl, if you could just give a brief introduction of you know, your life and how you've got to where you are today, and then we'll ask Scott to do the same thing.
Sure. I just turned 56 years old, and I grew up as the son of parents in the U.S. Foreign Service. So I spent a lot of time overseas in international environments. And consequently, the only time I would ever, you know, I'm black, and the only time I would ever experience racism would be when I would return home here to my own country, you know, the United States. And I could never figure it out, because overseas, I was around people from France, Germany, Italy, Nigeria, Japan, Russia, you name it. If they had embassies in those countries, you know, we all were together in international schools together, et cetera. And why I could get along with those people and couldn't get along with my own people back home was baffling to me. And, you know, you come home after being assigned to a country for 2 years. You're back here in the States for a year, and then you get reassigned somewhere else. So every time I'd come back, something would happen. And I began to question, you know, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? So as I got, you know, as I got older, I still had all these incidents cataloged in my mind, and I decided to write a book about racism. And who better to ask, how can you hate me when you don't even know me, would be somebody who would join an organization whose whole premise might be hate. So I decided, you know, that I would seek out leaders and members of the Ku Klux Klan and see if they would not sit down and talk to me and answer my question. You know, you don't know me, but yet you hate me because all you see is my black skin. So that's how the book got started, and it came out called Clandestine Relationships, clandestine spelled with a K, not a C. And I heard about Scott sometime later, you know, after the book had come out, and I was fascinated by him. Here's somebody who was in the organization. In fact, he wasn't just in it. He started being in it, but he rose to the level of Imperial Wizard, which is the top person in the organization. That's the national leader. And then he had decided upon himself to leave the organization. That fascinated me. So we contacted one another, and we've become very good friends. I'll let him take it from there.
Yeah, Johnny pretty much summed it up. Yes, of course, my background stems from probably the 1960s, being a product of the 1960s, growing up in the days of integration in the public schools in the state of Mississippi. My hometown of Indianola, Mississippi, was being integrated. And, of course, I was one of five kids in my family. And at the time, you know, of course, it was a culture shock to not only white people, but also to black people also. And they came into the schools, and they just, you know, pulled up into the front of the school with cotton trailers and told us, look, load your desk up onto the cotton trailer. We're taking you out of here. And that's basically what they did. They took us out and started sending us to private schools. Of course, I came from a family where my mother and father was not really, they were not racist. Or taught us any kind of racist ideas or anything at all, but the neighbors and the community in general, you know, of course, the racism was there, and they brought us into the public private schools. With the exception of myself, there was five kids, and my family couldn't afford to send us all to public private schools. Excuse me. So I ended up going to the predominantly black schools. And my town was divided by railroad tracks, like most Mississippi towns are still are. And I went down to the a black section of town, and probably was one of five white students in the school. And like I said, it was a culture shock for myself and a culture shock for the black students, too. And, you know, sure, we had problems and physical confrontations. And, of course, I also came from a broken home, also, you know, an alcoholic family and a lot of turmoil. this played a big part in myself because I grew up an unhappy child. I was not happy with myself. I did not like myself. And I reached out for something to make me feel better. I found myself a family within the white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan, and that's where my negative path went for that organization. I came across Daryl Davis. You know, I had heard about Daryl, and, you know, in my years in the Klan, and I remember hearing his story, and I said, well, excuse me, Daryl, but I said, who's this yo-yo? I mean, I don't understand this. And I didn't give it a whole lot of thought at the time. I just thought, you know, it was just someone out there just lost his mind. But after I got out of the movement, I came across Daryl's story, like you said, the clandestine relationships in his book, and I read about him on the Internet, and I contacted him. And probably one of the best things I did, because I've learned a lot from Daryl, and we have a great relationship and friendship, and I look forward to many, many more years of it. And happy birthday, Daryl. 56,
oh, thank
you're
you.
2 years older than me now.
Thank you. You know, Scott brings up a very important point there, John. He said, you know, that that his parents were not racist, so he wasn't raised that way. And see, that dispels the myth that a lot of people have. You know, people think, you know, well, he's in the Klan because his parents were in the Klan and their parents were in the Klan, so forth and so on. And that does happen. You know, that does exist where it's passed down from generation to generation. But that's not the only reason. You know, as you said, he came from a broken home or the environment in which he was in. So there are many, many different reasons why people join these organizations. And we should definitely, you know, dispel the myth that that every Klansman or Klanswoman is stamped out of a standard cookie cutter. They come from all walks of life, all occupations, all educational levels, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's really interesting, because I really agree with that, because, you know, I know people that have grown up with, and it doesn't have to be the white supremacist or things like that, but they've grown up with a certain way of doing things. And, you know, it's grandma did it this way and grandpa did it this way and, you know, their parents did it this way. And it was very hard for people to break away from that, you know,
right,
to turn. And that's what I wanted to ask you guys about. If there's someone listening that, you know, is in a situation where they found, however they got there, maybe it's like you're saying, Scott, you know, these people accepted you, this group accepted you in, you felt you had low self-esteem, they started helping you with, you know, this and that, you were becoming successful within the organization, and that alone is something. And then also there are people that, and Daryl and I talked about this before, one of the things that I always talk to my kids about and to people about is always ask questions, you know, always, even if it's, you know, authority and people that you respect, if you start thinking for yourself, right, I think that's the biggest thing. You start standing on your own two feet and start thinking, this is my decision. You know, I've got to make these decisions. Is that some of the things, Scott, that you were thinking of when you were in that situation with the KKK and you were finding success in the group, but you started asking questions about things and started thinking, okay,
for
I've
sure.
got to...
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, instead of accepting things, you start questioning things.
Oh, sure, yes. And like I said, I was very much looking for a place to fit in society. I didn't, you know, I didn't fit in my home or anything like that, and I was pretty much looking for a place to fit in, and the Klan gave me that. And sure, I started rising through the ranks, and they, of course, you know, gave me a place, gave me a family, gave me a home. They gave me confidence, gave me a boost, and then indoctrinated me with their rhetoric. And that's, you're right. I mean, that's what I was looking for, and I had a void in my life, and they filled it. And then, of course, over the years, there was always a doubt in my heart or in my mind or my heart, you know, do I really believe these things? And that kept popping up. That kept popping up over the years, and finally, you know, just life circumstances, you know, to a certain time and a period of my life where things happened, it gave me an opportunity to really look at myself and, of course, not not being a person or an alcoholic at the time of my, you know, of my own, you know, of course, I got in trouble with law enforcement, and they threw me into the court system. I got into the court system, and, I said, I'm going to figure a way to get out of these charges. I got caught with a weapon also, and I went into an alcohol and drug treatment center for the main purpose of just getting out of trouble. But what I didn't find and realize was when I went in, I was going to come out a different person, and that's what happened. And when, on the inside of that treatment center, I was able to sit down with other people of other races, other religions, and we had intimate conversations with each other. And not only did I realize that I did not actually know these people, and I knew nothing of them, I really found out what the true problem was. I did not have a problem with people of color. I did not have a problem with people of other religions. The problem was myself. The problem was Scott Shepherd, and that's what I come to find out and the problems that I was able to address and finally, leave the movement.
What's your advice to people, Scott, today that find themselves in situations like that? I know that one of the things that impresses me about both you guys, whether – It's your ability to listen and your ability to be patient with people and to not try to, cram things down people's throat or this is right and this is wrong and this is where you should be. One of the things that, from what I've read is always the ability to be able to sit down and find common ground and find a place where you can look someone in the eye and talk to them. To me, that's one of the most important things. Was that something also, Scott, that helped you turn your life around at that point?
Oh, definitely. Yes, I think you nailed it, pretty much, on target. Being able to sit down with other people, talk with other people of different races and religions and get to know them and find out about their life. Like I said, we had intimate conversations with each other about our lives. And I think you pretty much nailed it. That's, the patience and being tolerant of people and sit down and talk with them. And you really learn about the other people and they learn about you. And I think that's the biggest thing that we face that needs to be done.
If I can add something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in there, what he's saying is exactly right, And as he said, he's been in, he had been in that movement, dating back to the 60s. And so, it proves that it's not an instinctual kind of thing. It's a learned behavior, and he'd been indoctrinated over a period of time. So, you take that long to get saturated with that rhetoric. You don't unlearn it overnight. It takes a while, like you said, sitting down and talking with people of different races, having these intimate conversations. And when you do things like that, you find out, when you're talking with somebody one-on-one, even though you may look different or go to a different church or what have you, you find out that you really, at the end of the day, have more in common with that person than you do in contrast, because that person wants the same things for their family as you want for your family. And then you come to the conclusion, the light bulb comes on your head, hey, maybe if we can work together, we both can get those things rather than work against each other. And the second part of it is yes, the patience part. I understand, that people who've not had the exposure to a lot of different races, religions, ethnicities, what have you, they tend to become a little xenophobic, perhaps, and keep to themselves and don't want to associate with other people. Since I've already been there, I've associated with those people, I know they're okay, then I can have the patience for somebody who has not been there, and perhaps they can learn vicariously through me. And see, Scott is at that point now. Scott has been there. He sat down with the other races and people and seen, hey, these people are just like me. They have their problems. They have their triumphs. They're no different than I am, just because they're in a different colored skin or what have you. He's been there, and so now he understands that those people who were in his organization from before may not have had that experience. So therefore, he has the patience to sit down and tell them, hey, look, give it a shot. Just talk to these people. And that's very important because, see, there are other people who try to, ram it down your throat. You're wrong, and you need to come to your senses, and if you don't, I'm going to beat it out of you. Well, I'll tell you what, when you take that attitude, you know that you're going to, you know, enact violence on somebody who's racist against you or whatever. All you're doing really is reinforcing what they already believe. They already believe that you're violent and that you're and that you're dangerous and, you know, and you're dictatorial and all that kind of stuff. So when you force it on them, you simply prove their point.
Well, that's one of the things that's amazing to me is the ability to do that. And I want to talk about that, Daryl, where you have – when you went into some pretty dangerous situations. And could you share some of those with the listening audience?
Sure. I mean, every time, you know, you meet with somebody who doesn't know, A, that you're black, it could be a dangerous situation. And I would, now just about everybody in the Klan or the different Klan groups, you know, that are around the country now, let me give you a little background. You know, people always say the Klan. Well, there is no more the Ku Klux Klan. There is no more Ku Klux Klan Central. There are a lot of Ku Klux Klan organizations. They all use the name Ku Klux Klan, but they are not unified under one umbrella. You know, they have splintered off of the original. You know, you might have the Dixie Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the Territorial Knights, on and on and on. And these are separate autonomous groups. And if you have a chapter of your particular Klan group in your state and in another state or in multiple states, you may then consider yourself to be a national Klan group. And therefore, you appoint a national leader, which is known as the Imperial Wizard. And then for every state in which you have a chapter, you have a state leader, which is known as the Grand Dragon. So to us, it would be like a president or a governor. And then within the state, you have counties, and that individual is known as the Great Titan. And then within the counties, you have districts, or what they call claverns, and that leader is known as an Exalted Cyclops. So there are many different groups all, you know, scattered, you know, throughout the country, and even in one state, you might have, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 different Klan groups within that state. And the funny thing about it is, oftentimes, these Klan groups do not get along with each other because each one thinks, you know, they're the real deal and the other one is a wannabe Klan. Or somehow, you know, at the end of the day, they basically have the same agenda, but they have different avenues of getting there. So what I try to do is, you know, I try to, you know, go to as many as I can, whether they're all in the same state or scattered about the U.S. Like a few weeks ago, I was out in Harrison, Arkansas, meeting with the National Klan group out there and their leader. And then before that, I was in Indiana and then Pennsylvania. But some of these people, you know, I know ahead of time. And today, like I said, most of them know that I'm black, you know, if they hear the name Daryl Davis, because it's been out there for a while. But back when I was writing the book, I'd have my secretary, who was white, call them on the phone and say she works for this gentleman who's writing a book on the Klan. Would they consent to sitting down and speaking with me? And I instructed her not to tell the individuals, you know, that I was black unless they asked. If they asked, go ahead and tell them. But if they didn't ask, you know, don't give them any reason. The reason why I chose to do it that way, I could have called myself and said, hey, I'm writing a book on the Klan. You know, would you sit down and talk to me? I didn't want to do it myself because I figured, you know, they might pick up in my voice that I'm black and then say, no, I'm not talking to you, and hang up the phone. And then my project would have ended before it even got started. But I knew that if I had my secretary call, they would automatically know by her voice that she's white. And the mentality would not allow them immediately to think that this white woman was working for a black man, especially one who's writing a book on the Klan, because there were no black men writing books on the Klan. I was the first. There have been two books written by black authors that dealt with the Klan, but each author dealt with the Klan from the perspective of escaping a lynching, one in the 1930s and one in the 1940s, but not from the perspective of sitting down and speaking face-to-face in the same room with their potential would-be lynchers, and that's what I wanted to do. So, you know, when they would agree with my secretary, yes, you know, I'll sit down and talk with them, and we set up a time and a place. Sometimes, you know, we would meet at a restaurant or a hotel room or some, you know, neutral place. Other times they'd say, yeah, sure, you know, have them come over to the house. I live at, you know, whatever address, you know, not knowing that I'm black. And I'd go and I'd knock on the door. So, you know, that was always a shocker for a lot of them.
So could you walk us through, Daryl, You were just saying that you were in, I think, Arkansas a couple of weeks ago speaking to a Klan group there.
Yes, I met with the head of they're called the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. That particular Imperial Wizard, or what he calls himself, the National Director, is a fellow named Tom Robb. And now, he took over the group from the former Klan leader, David Duke.
Oh, okay. So we know that name. So I can imagine what it would be like, but what's your agenda like? What are your conversations like? What are your meetings like?
Well, I question them, where are you trying to go? What is it about the Klan that attracts you? Most of them have this, what you have is there's a new identity. Before, it was just two identities. You had white supremacy and you had white separatism. And to differentiate, a white separatist believes that, we all can live here in this country, but we can't live here together. We have to have separate school systems, separate neighborhoods, separate parks, separate workplaces, et cetera. So, segregated but equal kind of thing. Whereby a white supremacist believes, no, this country is for whites only, and everybody else has to get out or you'll be taken out. So you have people who belong to Klan groups, both of the white separatist ideology and those of the white supremacist ideology. Now we have a third identification, which is making the rounds right now, called white nationalism. And these people, the rhetoric now is, we don't hate other races, we just love our own. And we feel that that our race is going through genocide right now, because by the year 2042, whites in this country will be a minority. And so we're trying to preserve the white race by not having them miscegenate and all that kind of thing. So, that's what I talk about with them.
So, yeah, and that to me is amazing. I would love to be able to sit in and listen to that.
Well, we'll have to do that one day. And, and I'll tell you, there are those, like, for example, Tom Robb, I met him and some of his officers in his group. We met for lunch, and we sat down at the lunch table and had lunch together and discussed it. There are others, who would never sit down and have lunch with me. Forget it. And then there are those who would not, even talk to me at all.
Now, Daryl, explain to the listeners your motivation, because, and also, like we talked about a little bit before in the other show, Daryl, about how that, that ability to not just think, okay, I want to change the world, but to actually change the world, because you're actually doing things that are making people think. And when you sit down in front of people that are in leadership positions, like with Tom Robb and these people, I mean, you're making them stop everything that's going on and look you right in the eye and talk to you personally. To me, that's such an amazing thing. What is it that drives you to do that?
Because I can see the future, and I don't mean that I'm psychic. What I mean is, having traveled around the world, I've been in 52 different countries on 6 continents, and I made an amazing discovery. And that discovery is, no matter where I went, everybody that I met is a human being, regardless of what they look like or who they worship or if they worship at all. I knew that all along, but that was my discovery. And I realized that many people don't understand that, don't appreciate that. And I realize, that in order for this world to survive, in order for our country to survive, we have to respect one another. We have to get along with one another. We don't have to worry so much about external terrorists coming in here and destroying us. They've already done a little bit of that. But we are going to self-destruct if we don't get our acts together and start working with one another. And what I see a lot is, when I deal with neo-Nazis or people in the Klan or other white supremacist types or even black supremacist types, what they're saying is, I don't want my grandkids to be brown. And they're seeing the browning of America. And when you have been in the seat of power on the throne for so long, for 400 years or what have you, and all of a sudden the legs to your throne, to your chair, are being whittled down, and you're getting closer and closer to the peasants, on the ground, it starts to bother you, because you're going to lose that majority. And, you know, what happens when you become an equal? What happens when you become a minority? That's something very, very frightening. It's not frightening to me because I've been a minority all my life. But for somebody who has been a majority, who's always been in power all their life, and now all of a sudden, you know, they see themselves losing power, it can be troublesome to them. So, you know, we talk about that and say, hey, look, you know, if you believe in America, it's inevitable. America is evolving. It's always going to evolve. You know, right. Every year it's going to evolve. You either get on the bandwagon, and if you can't change what's going on, then you change yourself to adapt to it. And that's what we talk about.
Well, my guests, Daryl Davis and Scott Shepard, and you can go on daryldavis.com. Daryl is spelled with a D-A-R-Y-L. And check out his book, Clandestine Relationships, and it is with a K. And also I have Scott Shepard on, who is an ex-KKK Klansman, and we are having a great conversation. Guys, we'll take a music break, and we'll be right back after this. And please come back for the second part of the interview, the people that are listening, because we have some great things to talk about. And we'll be right back after this.
Love, love. Nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy. Yes, it's easy. All you need is love. All you need. Isn't known. Nothing you can see that isn't shown. No way you can be that isn't where you're meant to be. It's easy. You know it's easy. All you need.
I'd like to welcome everyone back to John Talk Radio. My guests tonight are Daryl Davis and Scott Shepard. And you can check Darryl out on his website, DarrylDavis.com. And Scott, I'd like to start this second part of the interview off with you. And with your experiences, I think one of the most incredible things about life and about being able to share conversations with people is that people take their lives and that their experiences, whether they're good or bad or whatever, and make positive steps forward. What is your advice, Scott, to people, just the average person out there, can do to help in the road to end racism? What are some of the small things that just anybody can do?
Well, I think one of the smallest things, but also one of the most important things, is sit down and talk to people. Sit down and talk to people that you don't know of other races and other religions. I think that's one of the most important things that we really need to do. And that's what I did, and I learned a lot. So I think, like I said, it may seem like a small task or a small thing to do, but it's also one of the most important things, and that's what needs to be done.
What were some of the impressions that people made on you, Scott, when you were, like, you said you were in groups, you know, talking about, you know, like the alcohol and the drug rehabilitation groups, and where your people were kind of turning things around, having you look inside yourself. But what were some of the things that impressed you with some of the people that you started thinking, okay, maybe there is a different way of looking at it, where I'm not going to judge somebody just because of their appearance, but I'm going to take time to do what you just said, Scott, where you can talk to somebody and take time to let them. And I think it's such an amazing thing, because you can look at somebody and you can think, gosh, I'll never get along with that person. But once you start talking to them, you find out, like Darryl, you said on several occasions, that you had that common ground and you can start building on that. What are some of the things that you can look back at, Scott, or some of the people that helped you along that way?
Well, I could look back and probably look at one of the most important turning points in my life is when I entered that Alcohol and Drug Treatment Center in Nashville, Cumberland Heights. Of course, I had made the headlines and the news where I'd been arrested, and because at the time I was also a candidate for governor of the state of Tennessee, and it made headlines. So I went into the drug treatment center, and I was called into the office of the director of the center, and he told me, he said, we've got black patients here, don't you? You know that, don't you? I said, yes, sir. He said, is that going to be a problem with you? I said, no, I just want to get in, do my 30 days and get out. And that was my plan. And, of course, The center is set up. It's not a hospital setting. It's a nice place. It's got cabins and things like that. And I was placed into a cabin, and inside this cabin was minorities, blacks, Oriental people of all races. But I made these people just as much uncomfortable as I was uncomfortable, because I remember the first morning that I woke up, I was sitting in the chair, and everybody was quiet. Everybody was not. Nobody was saying a word, and I noticed this one black guy across the room, and he was messing with his ironing board. And in messing with the ironing board, I kept watching him because he was real quiet. Next thing I knew, I looked up again, and this black guy was standing in front of me. He was dressed in white shoes, white socks, white pants, and a white shirt, and trying to mock my southern accent. He said, "Yo, I want to join the Ku Klux Klan," and just the humor of that kind of broke the ice for the whole stay. And I was able to sit down, and the guy's name is Michael. I hope he's still alive. I loved him to death and got real close to him, and that pretty much was a breaking point for myself to show me that, yeah, I can sit down and talk to these people and not intimidate them and not be intimidated myself. And that was an important step. And regardless, that black guy, Michael, might not know it, and he might not have realized it at the time, but the guy turned me around then.
That's just an amazing story. I mean, it could have gone the other way, you know. It could have gone, like Darryl was saying, it could have been confrontational, but it wasn't.
Oh, sure, definitely. Yes, it could have been. It could have been confrontational, and like I said, they were just as much. And not only the blacks, but the whites inside the treatment center too. They were all they all felt uncomfortable with me coming there, and I felt the same. And then I even told them I was going to Vanderbilt, the News, so the News wouldn't follow me, and ended up at Cumberland Heights. But they also told me at Cumberland Heights they knew I was coming there. So, you know, I don't know if they prepared anybody or not, but the guy turned me around, really did.
So what was it like from that point on, Scott, if you don't mind talking about it? I mean, from that point where you started understanding that there was more than what you were told and your beliefs, and that there was equality and to treat people equally, that couldn't have been an easy step to go back into the world and outside of the treatment center. What was that like?
Well, inside the treatment center, yes, I was exposed to counselors, group therapy, meetings with, you know, one-on-one meetings with counselors, not just group. And, I mean, I was able to explore and looking at myself in the mirror and asking, you know, what is really wrong here? Because once I was inside the treatment center, I started having some, you know, very conflicting emotions. And, yes, I cried a lot, you know, more than once, and learned a lot. And that, like I said, that is pretty much what turned me around. But when I got on the outside of the treatment center, my racist life really did not end when I was inside the treatment center. It took me a couple of years, between 2 and maybe 4 years, to really grasp what had happened to me inside that treatment center, because I was really torn. It was like, you know, here I was. This was a family. The Ku Klux Klan was a family. They took me in, became my family. And now, what was I doing? I walked out of that treatment center, and I was leaving a family. I was actually doing exactly what, you know, attracted me to the Klan. I was ended up without a family again. But this time I had my head on straight. I knew what was wrong, and I knew what I had to work on. And I went, like I said, I went in one person and came out another. And it wasn't easy. It was not easy at all, but with work and continued visits and talks with people, sure, I was able to get through it.
I agree with the fact, Scott, that it's just like, it's not an overnight thing with anyone. I mean, we're all human, and we all have all kinds of thoughts and things that go on and through us all the time. And people, I think it's important to understand that things aren't just going to change like a bolt of lightning and everything's going to be different, because you have to, like I think you said, Daryl, there's a learned behavior. And
right, you have to unlearn it.
Yep.
And it's like losing weight. You know, you put it on over time, and you're not going to lose it the next day because you popped some weight loss pill.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, I'm going to ask you, Daryl, the same question I asked Scott about what can the person that's listening, the average person that goes to work every day, whether they're, you know, African-American or they're white or, you know, Latin or whatever they are, what can they do? I mean,
okay, I can answer that in one phrase.
Okay.
Take a walk across the cafeteria. And what do I mean by that? You go to some, a lot of people who may not be racist at all, people in general tend to self-segregate. People feel more comfortable being around somebody who looks like them or who speaks the same language as them or what have you. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're racist. It could be that they just, you know, feel more comfortable. So unless you've grown up in an environment where you have all kinds of different people, then you might tend to self-segregate. You take a look at any, you know, metropolitan town, say Washington, D.C., which is near where I live, or Chicago, where I'm from originally, New York City, Baltimore, Memphis, Detroit, what have you, Los Angeles. These places take a company. Inside that company, you have employees of all races, and they may work together on a project. Some of them may even share the same cubicle in their office. But what happens at 12 noon? They go downstairs to the cafeteria in the building, and then they split up. The Hispanics sit with the Hispanics, the blacks sit with the blacks, the whites sit with the whites. And does that mean that they're racist? Not necessarily. You know, again, that's that self-segregation where they tend to feel more comfortable being around somebody who shares some kind of identity with them. But what you do is take a walk across the cafeteria and sit with somebody else for a change. See what they're all about, because everybody has something to teach and everybody has something to learn. And the beauty of it is when those two things are exchanged, because we all are puzzle pieces, and the puzzle is not complete until those pieces get linked up.
That's a great point. What do you think about that, Scott?
Well, I think it's true. Of course, I can say this. Of course, when, on the inside of the Ku Klux Klan, and when I was speaking out, for white supremacist views, it's kind of strange. Of course, hearing Darryl say that, because what he's saying is true, and it doesn't mean that you're racist or anything like that. But I also, at the time, I used that as an example and tried to say, the race, the mixing of races is wrong. Only separation of the races should ever take place. And I use that as an example. You go to a public cafeteria and people of, blacks are sitting together, whites are sitting together. But like Darryl said, it doesn't mean you're racist. It means that, you're just more comfortable with your own kind. But, yes, go ahead, walk across the cafeteria, sit down with those people and talk to them and get to know them. And like I said, talking is one of the most important things.
One thing I'll say is when two enemies are talking, they're not fighting.
That's a great point.
They may be disagreeing, but they're talking. They're not fighting. It's when the talking ceases that the ground becomes fertile for violence and things like that. But as long as you're talking, as long as you keep the lines of communication open, you're not fighting. And hopefully, during that conversation, you come across things that you have in common, and the need or desire to fight, gets diminished.
What are some of the things, Darryl and Scott, that you do to build on that when you are talking and you find positive things that you agree on? You have to be able to cultivate that and to get that to grow. How do you do that?
Scott, you go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Darryl. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, I would find something in common, something that has no discriminatory powers. For example, like Scott mentioned, alcohol and drugs. Alcohol and drugs do not discriminate. They affect blacks the same way they affect whites or Hispanics or Asians or anybody else. And so you find somebody, who's having, that kind of a situation, and you can share, hey, you know what, I'm in that same situation. Let's talk about it. What did you do to get sober, or how do you deal with this? Or whatever you find in common, whether it's drugs or alcohol, or you all like the same kind of movie, or you like the same song, the same movie, the same music, whatever. You build upon the commonality, and the more you build upon the commonality, the less the differences matter.
Well,
because they begin to see you as a human being.
Absolutely, and you hit one thing I was going to ask next. How to me, it's such a big thing, but the power of music to reach people, to be able to cross boundaries. Talk about that. How amazing that is! You being a musician, you've got to
totally
see that
amazing.
A lot.
I'll tell you two quick stories. The first time I met a Klansman was in this bar. I was playing in a country western bar, and it was an all-white bar. When I say all-white, I don't mean that blacks couldn't go in there. I mean that blacks did not go in there by their own choice, and it was a good choice because they were not welcome. But here I was in this place, and I was the only black guy in there, only black guy in the band, only black guy in the whole bar. And on the first break, I was heading to a table to sit down, and this white gentleman came up behind me and put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, I really like your all's music. And I said, well, thank you. I appreciate that. And shook his hand. And he said, I've seen this band before, but I've never seen you before. Where'd you come from? And I said, well, I just joined the band about a little bit ago. And he says, well, yeah, I never seen you before. And he says, this is the first time I ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't offended, but I was kind of, surprised. Like, has this guy never seen Fast Domino or Little Richard or, whatever? And I said, well, how was that? He goes, well, I ain't never heard no black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis, and you're doing it. And I said, well, Jerry Lee Lewis learned that style from the same place I did. And he said, well, where is that? And I said, from black blues and boogie-woogie piano players. That's where rock and roll came from. And the guy, disputed me and, no, Jerry Lee invented that. He don't learn nothing like that from black people. And we argued back and forth. I told the man, that I've known Jerry Lee Lewis personally since I was 13 years old. He's a good friend of mine. He's told me himself. Well, the guy didn't buy it, but he wanted to buy me a drink. And I went to his table and had a drink with him. It turns out, you know, I don't drink alcohol, but I had a cranberry juice. And turns out he was a member of the Klan. But he was drawn to me because he was fascinated with my ability to play the piano that way. He'd just never been exposed to a black musician playing that kind of music, not realizing that it was blacks who created rock and roll, you know, and was whites who promoted it. You know, Elvis Presley used to go down on Beale Street in Memphis and listen to all these black blues and people like that. But Elvis became the greatest, you know, promoter of rock and roll and probably the most well-known rock and roller. But it was those like Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Fats Domino and Bo Diddley who actually invented the music. So, you know, he was fascinated with me, and we developed a friendship over time. And to give you another example that, you know, that can be applied, if you work for a computer company or you work for a bank or whatever, and you have a party, all the people at your party are going to be either bank-oriented or computer-oriented. You might have hardware people, IT people, software people, programmers, computer sales, all computer-oriented people. But when you go to hear music in a bar or in a nightclub or whatever, where there's a live band or a DJ, everybody's going to be there because everybody likes music. There are going to be computer people there. There are going to be bankers there. There are going to be restaurateurs, counselors. You know, every vocation will be there because everybody likes music. So if you, John Darlington, walk into a bar and the DJ is playing this song that you like or the band is playing some song that you like, let's say it's a slow song, and you look out on the dance floor and people are dancing and you want to dance, but you're there by yourself. And so you want to dance. You look around. You see if you see any single lady, you know that you might ask to dance. So you see this one single lady sitting at the bar, and she's patting her foot or patting her hand on the bar. Obviously, she likes the song, and you don't know her, but you walk up to her and say, "Hey, you know, would you care to dance?" And she says, "Yeah, sure." So you come out there on the dance floor, and you get your arms around her. She has her arms around you. You don't know each other, but that music has brought you together. All right. And you dance around, the song ends, you escort her back to her seat like a gentleman, and you say, "Hey, my name is John Darlington." She says her name is whatever, and she says to you, "You know, so what do you do?" And you say, "Well, I'm a busboy at Joe's Steakhouse down the street." And, you know, "What do you do?" And she tells you she's a vice president for the eastern region of Microsoft or something. Well, guess what? You know, you're making less than $10,000 a year, and she's making over $250,000 a year. Where would two people that diverse be brought that close together? Music did it. And you all didn't even know each other. So, you know, music does soothe the savage beast.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I've seen that happen. I mean,
yeah, I have too. I've experienced it.
And it's just amazing. Well, guys, we have just a short period of time left. I have about 6 minutes left, and I just want to thank both of you for taking your time. This has been an amazing show. I've learned a lot. I really appreciate what you guys have both done, and I want to thank both of you for what you're doing today.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm going to ask you both.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's great having you on, Scott, and I want to ask both of you. I'm going to give you just closing statements to say what you would like to say. I know there's been some racism things in the news recently with, you know, the L.A. Clippers and that kind of thing, and the shooting at the Jewish Center and things that have made headlines. And I just like you guys to take time, you know, in your closing statements just to talk about, you know, what we can do together as a group of people to end that kind of stuff and to make it a better place. But Scott, would you like to start off?
Sure. Of course, you mentioned the shootings, of course, in Kansas. I knew that guy personally, and years ago he stood out as a violent person then, and, of course, a lot of people didn't have anything to do with him, and I was one. But, you know, you can't really look at that man and lump everybody into the same category, because I think that man has some mental problems, you know, other than his racism. But I think one of the main things, like I said, we just need to sit down and talk with each other and get to know each other, find out what makes this person tick, what makes yourself tick, your common ground, and then build from that. Carol made a good point about the music. I could go on and on about that, but time's short. You know, I've seen the music work from being from the Delta Blues to Memphis. I've seen what music and the blues can do as far as race relations. And I think we just need to just build from where we're born, get to know each other, and go forward and never give up.
Never give up. That's great advice. Thanks, Scott. Daryl?
I agree 100% there with Scott. Never give up. You know, always pursue that conversation. And one thing that we tend to do in this country is we put a lot of taboos on a lot of subjects. Sex education in schools, talking about racism. These are not common, you know, coffee table topics, but they need to be. They need to be. We need to take the taboo off so we can become more well-informed. When I was in high school or whatever back then, you had to bring a note, a signed note in from your parents if you wanted to take sex ed. You know, that was a big issue. It was taboo. But today, sex ed is commonplace in schools. So therefore, kids today are better informed about STDs and venereal disease and family planning and contraception, all that kind of stuff. And that's a good thing. It's good to be informed, because if you're not informed the right way, you will learn it anyway out there on the street, and chances are it'll be the wrong way. So the taboo has been lifted off of sex ed, at least in my area, you know, where I went to school. The same taboo is applied to talking about race. That taboo needs to be lifted up, and everybody needs to be able to talk, you know, unafraid, and turn all their cards up, face up on the table, and talk about what they fear or what they feel. And that way those issues can be addressed.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's such an amazing thing to be able to just sit down, and sometimes it's not easy. And that's why I think you guys are doing such a great job, because that initial contact with people and that initial breaking the ice is not going to be easy, but it's going to be so valuable down the road.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, thank you so much. I appreciate it. We'll have to do this again. I would love to have you back on. And
love to do it.
Well, thanks. And you guys have a great evening. I want to thank everyone for listening. My guests are Daryl Davis and Scott Shepherd. This interview will be in podcast about 10 minutes after the 7 o'clock tonight. So want everybody to share it with your friends and family and get the conversation going. Thank you so much, guys, and have a great evening. And thanks for listening tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Yeah.
Karen Lee, Karen Lee, Karen Lee.